Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and glad to have you with us today. I'm going to be talking with Steve Bauer. He is the Executive Director of FEA, which stands for Federal Employees Education and Assistance Fund. And FEA is a Feds Helping Feds charity. And boy, are they going to need it now. We're in the midst of sequestration, continuing resolutions, extensions, lots of confusion in the top ranks of the federal government as to how to handle these automatic cuts, across-the-board cuts, which in some cases now are not being made across the board. But it's panicked a lot of federal workers. Defense originally started out saying it was going to furlough virtually everybody, all 750,000 employees, for 22 days. It has cut that back now to something like 14 days, but that's still a frightening prospect, and other agencies are running the numbers to see what they have to do and what they can avoid doing. Steve, are you with us?
I am indeed.
Hey, thank you for being there. I know it's dark 30 out there in Colorado. You are in Colorado?
I am in Colorado.
Okay.
For the moment.
Okay. Home base, yeah. Steve, you should do most of the talking here, but can you explain just briefly what FEA is, and then we'll get right into how it can help people.
Absolutely. FEA was born in 1986 and was set up as a charity just for civilian federal employees and their families. We're the only ones, the only charity that does just helping to civilian federal employees. There are military organizations that preceded us for Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, and so on. When federal employees run into trouble, and the trouble can take any number of forms, it can be a personal emergency, it can be a natural disaster, it can be an unnatural disaster like a bombing of a federal building, or an attack on the Pentagon, FEA is there to help federal employees. We also do have a scholarship program each year for federal employees that awards scholarships to employees continuing their education as well as to their children to go to school, since federal employees tend to be in that great middle class, which means that they're a little too rich to get financial aid but too poor to send their kids to college.
Right, and this is what the 18th anniversary of the bombing at the Murrow Building in Oklahoma City.
Just a couple of weeks from now,
yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, that was one of your baptisms by fire, and FEA at that time, I believe, promised a full ride scholarship to the school of their choice to all of the children who lost parents in that horrible day.
Yeah, I was the one that made that promise, not realizing at the time that we were talking about 200 children. It's a lot of kids to put through college, but we're getting close to 190 that have already been put through college, full-ride scholarships. We're very proud of those children who've recovered from the loss of a parent. We have still about a dozen to go. We have six in college this year. I'm getting more and more confident to say that we're going to do what we said we were going to do and help every single one of those children.
And I believe one of those now students had not been born when the parents were killed.
The youngest was born 3 months after the bombing.
Wow.
Exactly. So it's a 23-year program, and 18 years into it, we're very proud of what we've been able to accomplish.
Well, it is wonderful. I know you told me one time in another chat that an awful lot of these students, they could have done anything given the educations they were able to have, but many of them went into service professions and medical and healing and that kind of thing.
Absolutely. I think it's a testament to their parents who are public servants, their physical therapists, their special educators. Not a lot of MBAs there.
Yeah.
They're giving back.
Very interesting. See, to today, right now, we're looking at sequestration, which people are still trying to understand what that means, how it's going to work, despite the political nattering on both sides of the aisle. But the bottom line is people are facing furloughs. The maximum now, I believe, is the 14 that defense is talking about. Some have backed off the dates. But even so, if you're just making ends meet, if you're a single parent with a couple of kids and in a fairly low-paying job in a high-priced city, losing one day of pay is a disaster. And I talked to a woman this morning, and because I'd done a column about, you know, people should have nest eggs, et cetera, and she said her nest egg is her daughter's college fund, and her daughter starts college this fall.
Wow. Absolutely, Mike. People have been calling us regularly, trying to prepare for furloughs to see what they could, what help they might be able to get. We have to put it in perspective. It's crazy times. Nobody has had a furlough day yet, to the best of my knowledge, but it certainly looks imminent for at least a half a dozen different agencies and a lot of people, possibly as many as 750,000 people, because besides DOD, we're still looking EPA, HUD, IRS, Justice, Labor, FAA are still all talking furloughs. We have to put in perspective, the agencies are looking at saving something like $4.5 billion in payroll costs. In a typical year, FEA will do $1 million in assistance to federal employees. So it's kind of like saying, Steve, my friend, I need $4,500, and I say, I got one.
Yeah.
So we're not going to be able to help everybody. We can't replace those paychecks. That's not what we're in the business of doing. But the folks that have furloughs and other things happening to them where they literally can't pay their rent, they're looking at evictions, they're looking at foreclosures, they're looking at utility shutoffs, those folks should be coming to us, applying for the emergency assistance grants or loans. In most cases, we'll do no interest loans. Federal employees like that. They pay it back. It goes back into the fund to help more people. And they can do that right from our website, feea.org. So they can go there, get the emergency assistance application, and apply. Like I said, nobody has been furloughed yet, so we haven't had any furlough applications, but I'm sure they'll be coming, and we're going to do our best to help everybody that needs help.
Well, how are you doing financially? Because I know that the overall rate of contributions to the combined federal campaign was down last year, and I believe the year before as well.
Yes, CFC has been tough sledding for people. I am really pleased to report that the year before we stayed even, and this year it looks like we're up 10%. Federal employees, I think, are recognizing the value of FEA as they haven't gotten raises year after year. They're finding it harder and harder to meet all their obligations. So they have recognized FEA. I think part of it was in the fall. We were helping a lot of people from Hurricane Sandy, and agencies were letting folks know that help was available from FEA. And those folks that were lucky enough in the on the East Coast not to have property damage were giving to FEA. So it was very heartening. But even having said that, we're still looking at a ratio of 4,500 to 1 in terms of how we're going to be able to help people.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I talked to several people. I know several people who, here in the Washington area, we were supposed to be in the bullseye of Hurricane Sandy. And she missed us. She went up the coast, hit New Jersey very hard, New York very hard. We all know what happened to Manhattan. But a lot of people here, I think, sort of breathed a sigh of relief and then gave money to different charities, from the Red Cross to FEA. And I know a number of church groups that went up there and did work, but it was sort of like, thanks for missing us.
Yeah, I grew up in New York, and it was absolutely amazing. I did visit, and some of the damage was truly beyond belief, and there were a number of federal employees who either totally lost their home or had it flooded in part and had to move out, had needed temporary quarters. Flood insurance is a big variable. Some people had it, some people didn't. So a lot of folks needed help, and we were very pleased to be able to help all of those federal employees. We didn't turn anyone down because we didn't have money.
So. Right. Thanks. Steve, hold on here. We need to take a short break here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. Lauren Larson is producing the show today, as she does every week, and we have Steve Bauer on the line. Steve's executive director of FEA, the Federal Employees Education and Assistance Fund, and they make loans, sometimes grants, to federal workers in need, and they also have a wonderful scholarship program. Steve, can outsiders, somebody like me, for example, do you accept money from the general public?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Anybody can give. We're a 501c3 charity, just like Red Cross or American Heart Association or Alzheimer's Association. People can give online at feea.org, and we're encouraging employees, federal employees, who either did or did not give to us in the combined federal campaign to donate online. We're asking employees who are not going to be furloughed and can afford it to give $10 or more so we can help more employees when the furloughs actually do occur.
Well, I know Emily Koppel on the federal drive this morning said that D.C. Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton has said she's going to give money to FEA, or maybe already has, because of the furloughs. Situation.
She announced that indeed she, bless her heart, is going to donate some of her pay. A number of days that the maximum number of days that any federal employee is furloughed, she's going to donate that amount of her pay. So if 14 days is the maximum furlough, she'll donate 14 days of her pay, half of it to FEA and half to her staff, who is subject to furlough as well.
Wow, that's voting with your feet and your wallet, isn't it?
Just an amazing thing for her to do, and it generated some good publicity for us as well as for her. It shows that some people recognize that, you know, federal employees are a great mix of folks. It's like your neighborhood.
Yeah.
During the housing crisis, people that I knew, they had their house foreclosed. They lost their job, couldn't find one. They were upside down on their mortgages. People that you would never expect. So federal employees run the gamut, from those that are, you know, two-earner, no kids, and doing quite well, to those single parents struggling with three or four kids. You mentioned the woman this morning.
Right. Her
going off to college.
Her nest egg is her daughter's college fund, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, now, see, if I'm a federal worker, so you haven't made any loans or grants yet, obviously, because there have not been any furloughs yet. But suppose I'm furloughed a day here and a day there, and I get behind in the electricity or I need some money to cover the mortgage payment. How do I approach you?
Well, you go to feea.org. You get the application there. It tells you the documentation that's required. We ask that you show you're a federal employee, how long you've been a federal employee, what your income and outgo is, what your problem is, documentation of that, like if you have a shutoff notice from the gas company, mm-hmm. You would submit that showing how much you owe. And, in fact, what we do in a case like that is we make a check out to the gas company so we know it's going to the right place, and we are, in fact, helping that person the way we intended to help that person.
Okay. So do you have any idea of – have you – I mean, obviously you've done this before in some situations, huh?
Yes. You know, you mentioned the furloughs earlier that at Christmas time years ago, back then it was before everybody was emailing and doing things electronically,
yeah.
And there were websites. We were inundated with applications, very few of which we ended up having to process because people got back pay and everything was okay. But there was a two-week period where people were absolutely panicked. Our mail trucks were delivering our mail. Our fax machine, the old thermal paper, was going nonstop. NBC Nightly News came out to our office to show the impact.
Yeah.
It was crazy, and there were people that were hurt even then. There was a lot of when actually employed employees, as they're called. That means they get paid only when they work. There was no authority to go back and pay them. So there were folks that indeed suffered during that period of time. So we know we'll be inundated. You know, and if we're talking 850,000 people, if you just take 1%, that's 2 years' worth of work for us that
yeah.
we'll have to process in just a couple of months.
Right, and the past is not always prologue, too, because the shutdown of 95-96, in fact, everybody got retroactive pay, and most people didn't even get a short check. The timing was such that Congress voted the money and they got paid again. But we know for sure this time that when and if there are furloughs, that people won't get them. So now, I know the difference between a grant and a loan, but what is the definition of it, and how do you decide who gets what?
Well, in most cases like this, they would be loans. Grants are usually reserved for people that if we made a loan to them and they had to pay us back, even though it's a no-interest loan and we give them a year to pay us back, that it would put them right back into the same situation. So,
yeah,
you know, talking about paying the gas company to keep the gas going, if we made that as a loan and the person having to pay us back would create the same situation recurring 6 months from then, we would make it a grant.
Okay. And do they make the little loans, do the loans come directly from you? Do you have the cash on hand, or are you sort of a middleman?
No, it's our cash. It's
okay.
Our cash. This is not through a bank, and we're not a bank. That's why we do no interest loans. If we actually charge people interest, we'd have to register in every state as a financial institution.
Okay.
So these come directly out of our funds. If we don't have any money, we can't even make loans.
Okay, so you're not only prepping for loans, but you need people to send you some cash, too.
Exactly. If there's no money in the bank, then there's no money to write checks to the gas company. So we need people to donate, absolutely. And it's interesting, we got a new way this year. I heard just before the show come on an advertisement for it, and you guys are one of the sponsors. The 5K race the first week in May is going to be a benefit for FIA, and that's also celebrating Public Service Recognition Week. So we've got a lot of corporate sponsors lined up, and we're hoping to bring in a lot of money just at the right time for helping people who have been furloughed.
Well, I was going to ask you about the corporate sponsors, because I know I've been at some of these banquets and Phillips facilities with you, and they've handed over some very, very big checks. Who are these corporations?
It's nice to mention them because feds need to know that they're actually people that do love them. Blue Cross and Blue Shield Federal Employee Program has been our largest corporate sponsors for years. And if we do run into trouble with furloughs, I have a anticipation that they will somehow find some additional money to give us.
And Ed Hayes will be on the case, right?
You got it. Exactly. I even talked to her earlier this morning. They made a nice contribution for the 5K race so that every registration fee will end up coming to FIA. We've covered all the costs involved with the race already. GEICO is another that's been a supporter for years and years. Long-term care partners, feds, people that you know and you talk to all the time. They all are giving back to the federal community.
Well, that's really good to hear. I love getting you to tell this story. It shows you the scope of FIA, but you've been in some interesting situations, Hurricane Katrina, and I believe there was one some years back, really, really bad hurricane that went through Central Florida, and you went to the bank, I guess in near Denver, and got a suitcase full of money and flew it to Florida?
Exactly. It was Hurricane Andrew, and it was southern Florida, and Homestead, Florida really got wiped out, and got a call that federal employees needed help, and they needed cash. And the reason that they needed cash was there was no electricity, and they knew there wouldn't be for weeks and weeks, so you couldn't go to the ATM. The Homestead Savings and Loan, which was the big bank in Homestead, Florida, literally was wiped off the face of the earth. There was just a foundation left. It was terrible down there. So I at that time, FIA was fairly new, and we didn't have that much money. I virtually emptied out our bank account, got $50 and $100 bills, put them in an envelope, put them in the inside jacket of my pocket, and flew to Miami. Kind of nervous about it, obviously. It was a little hard getting through security because I wasn't taking off my jacket with
right.
$20,000 in cash in it. So we got a little disagreement with the supervisor at TSA, but they finally let me through. And now I'm thinking, okay, back then it was the war on drugs,
oh, yeah.
not the war on terrorism. So here's a nervous white guy with $20,000 and $50 and $100 bills in his pocket flying to Miami, Florida, of all places.
You definitely fit the profile, too.
I did.
I would take you out of the line.
And I actually got picked up by the Customs Service, but that was planned. They
yeah.
picked me up in a helicopter and flew me down to Homestead because that's the only way you could get down there. And we were able to literally hand out money to people who needed it to buy water, generators, all sorts of supplies. So
and what year was that? Because $20,000 was a lot of money then.
That was 1989.
Yeah, I remember well. And you know, I know you've been in some other situations where it really is an all-in-the-family deal because some federal agency will pick you up, the Postal Service or something, and you have people from the VA and Social Security, and they're down there handing out money or checks to people, because as you pointed out, it's not just electricity. You know, when Mount St. Helens, the volcano blew some years back, and our friend Jerry Shaw's father lived in the fairly near to it, and they didn't have ATMs working for months. They were living off barter and whatnot. But people don't realize what happens, the lingering effects of disasters, particularly things like hurricanes and floods.
Absolutely, and, you know, some of those needs like electricity or water or 24/7 needs. So we often have volunteers from federal families. Often those families, you know, have been impacted themselves, you know, people who've lost their homes or their cars, but they're volunteering, helping FIA stay open, running checks out to people or cash out to people, paying people's bills, literally doing whatever needs to be done. It's just the spirit of federal employees, that public service.
Well, I hope you get it. Hope we don't need to do it, but I hope you get it. And I may even pass the hat around here at the station. So thank you, Steve Bauer, for being with us. And I hope to see you, I guess, maybe in a couple of weeks here in D.C., huh?
I'm looking forward to it.
All right, here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. We'll be right back to talk with Sean Riley from the Federal Times. Welcome back to Your Turn. I'm Mike Causey, and I'm going to be talking with Sean Riley. He's a senior writer with the Federal Times. Sean, are you with us?
Yeah, hi. How
hey,
are
thanks
you,
for taking time out here. I can see by your paper you have been extremely busy this week and last as well. You know, my thought on the sequestration process, the shifting of funds, the continuing resolution, and all these political things is that if you have been paying attention, you must be confused.
Well, there are a lot of moving pieces to this, and, you know, complicating it is the fact that Congress waited almost 6 months before passing a full year budget or full year continuing resolution in many agencies' cases for fiscal 2013. And what happened in the legislation that was signed a week or so ago was that they gave some agencies, particularly those with some kind of security function, a little bit more money or a little more flexibility in how they handle those funds. So now you see a couple of agencies, including the Department of Justice, Customs and Border Protection, and the Defense Department, either announcing changes to their plans for dealing with sequestration, or at least putting those plans on hold for a little while they look at the implications of this newly passed budget.
Yeah, I mean, so it really is a constantly moving thing.
Right. I mean, as you know, the big news was that last week the Defense Department announced that it would, instead of furloughing civilian employees for up to 22 days, the number would now be 14. Instead of taking effect next month, the furloughs would begin in June. Now, they're still trying to work out exactly how many employees will be exempt from furloughs. That's going to be a contentious process internally, I imagine. But it is, it does mean, you know, essentially there will be a reduction in 8 days and how in the number of furloughs, the length of furloughs for probably the vast majority of DOD civilians. And, of course, the Defense Department is the government's largest civilian employer.
I talked with a defense civilian in Korea, and he said, I'm here in the firing line, as it were, with the threats that they're making from the North, and that he had not been exempted from this yet. So he's potentially going to be furloughed there out in Korea.
I just wonder how they're going to make all of this work. The one thing that, and I'm sure there are an awful lot of interesting stories to be told by agency managers, as this process goes forward, but how you manage to get people to take the required time off and at the same time keep your organization running, I think that's going to be a fascinating story.
Yeah, and this is so complicated, and this is by law, too. These are laws that the Congress made some time ago and a president signed some time ago. But as I understand it, if you're on travel and you're furloughed, even for one day, you're supposed to come home.
Well, somehow, if you're in Korea or if you're abroad, I'm not sure that'd be cost effective.
No.
But yeah, those are kind of details that have to be worked out.
Right, and cost effective sometimes doesn't even come into it. These are the rules. And in order to save $250, we must spend $750.
Well, if that's I guess you got to comply with the law. But hopefully, common sense they'd come up with some sort of common sense solution.
Yeah, we've been saying that for years. The common sense prevailing. But Sean, you have interesting piece today, the good news, bad news. You're saying that the president will likely call for a 1% federal pay raise. That's the good news, but there's another part to that, isn't there?
Possibly. I mean, and I should say, should say at the outset, the White House Budget Office, the Office of Management Budget, is not confirming anything,
right.
Any particular details of what's going to be in the president's fiscal 2014 budget request, which will be released a week from today. But the according to federal employee union leaders, OMB officials told them earlier this year that the president would propose a 1% across the board increase for 2014. However, they're also anticipating that he will revive plans to eliminate the FERS supplement, for FERS retirees who are not old enough or not eligible for Social Security immediately, and also propose increases propose increases in what federal employees contribute for both to the federal employees retirement system and the civil service retirement system.
And they've already raised the contribution rates for FERS people who joined after January 1, correct?
That's correct, yeah, and it's a significant increase. And what if going on, if you're assuming that the past is prologue, what they'll do is propose increases. This would be a 1.2% increase for both CSRS and FERS participants to be phased in over 3 years.
And that's the administration plan. And, of course, there's a Republican plan that would be even more than that, wouldn't it?
Well, the Republican plan essentially wants to even out what federal employees and agencies contribute to the pension plans. Right now, it's heavily the contributions, or most of the contributions, are picked up by the agencies. What's being proposed by the budget resolution approved by the House. This is the handiwork of House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan. The Republicans want to equalize those contributions. So, say for right now, a FERS an employee covered by FERS contributes 0.8% of salary to FERS. Assuming that you were going to equalize the contributions for employees and agencies, that would go up to over 6% of salary. So, close to around a 600% increase.
Yeah.
Now that's, it's not binding, but this, the budget resolution is not binding, but this is an indication of the direction in which at least some members of Congress would like to go.
Well, I remember you'd said that before, and the news in the past week has been a number of cities are going bankrupt, about to declare bankruptcy, including some big ones, and they blame it primarily on the pay raises, but pension costs for their city and municipal employees.
That's right. I think Stockton, California, has been in the news on exactly those on exactly that issue this week. There's a question I think about whether the situation of state and local governments is exactly comparable to the federal. What's going on in the federal government? I think in the case of cities like Stockton and I think San Bernardino, I believe also in California, they were hammered by the recession and by the collapse of the property, the real estate market, which of course hurt their property tax collections. I don't think there's any indication, at least not that I'm aware of, that the federal government's situation is anywhere near as dire. And, of course, the federal government can print money to make up any deficits, which is not always an option for state and local communities.
Well, I was thinking more of the public perception, when you read that, Detroit's in receivership and Wisconsin made major changes in its pay and benefits of its public employees. I think a lot of people, not in this area so much, but a lot of people lump all the government together.
That's a very good point, and I think there might be some spillover effect in that regard. And there's also, I think, a perception issue, at least among some members of the public and elected officials, is that federal employees have, compared to their counterparts in the private sector, have it pretty good. Most private sector employees no longer have a defined benefit pension program where when you retire what you're going to receive. Most private sector employees now, people in the private sector rely on 401ks or personal savings or whatever, and so for from that vantage point, the fact that federal employees have any kind of pension, defined benefit pension program, looks pretty good.
Yeah, and I know I called a very, very large, rich company back when it was large and rich one time and asked it when's the last time its retirees got a cost of living adjustment, and they said, what's a cost of living adjustment? So they don't do that in the private sector. Sean, I got a question here directly for you. Says only 28% of the Department of Labor employees are being furloughed. Can we say that those 28% are from agencies that have been mismanaged? Why were other agencies able to find savings unrelated to employee salaries when mine, and she listed here, was not? The district offices have no control over their budgets, so it sounds like the blame belongs to the agency director.
That's a great question, and I'm not completely familiar with what's going on in the Department of Labor, though I am familiar with, the 28% figure. I think it's very complicated, and this is an issue that's surfacing throughout the federal government, that there does seem to be some inconsistency, not only between agencies, but even within agencies, about who's getting furloughed, who isn't. I think there are a number of different issues involved. One is how proactively agency managers or component managers prepared for the possibility of sequestration, whether they were making efforts even before sequestration began last month to save money, essentially, to limit hiring, limit issuance of new contracts, that kind of thing. But also, I think another factor is where your money comes from. Receive a funding stream or revenue that's not appropriated by Congress, that's perhaps not subject to sequestration, you're in a much better situation than an agency or component that is wholly dependent on appropriated funds. So I certainly wouldn't assume that agency mismanagement or component mismanagement is responsible for somebody getting furloughed. I think there are a bunch of different factors involved.
I can see where somebody would think that. On the other hand, the reverse of that is that the agencies are doing the best they can under the circumstances, and they're finding savings or finding ways to shift it in some situations, and in others they're just not finding it. So they're not being inept. They're being detail oriented.
I agree, and I mean, we have to remember this is as far as I know, an unprecedented situation. I mean, there has sequestration has occurred before many years ago, but a much much more limited scale than is the case today. And it's inevitable that this process of implementation will not proceed perfectly, and there are going to be an awful lot of issues that have to be worked out, and we're basically kind of doing this, or agencies are doing this as they go along.
All right, we'll take a short break here. We'll be right back on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Talking with Sean Riley. He's a senior writer with the Federal Times and frequent commentator here. Sean, I see this reminds me of, and not to minimize it, but it's sort of like the Cold War or the War on Terror. This is going to be with us for a long time. I'm looking at your story here about defense is going to consider layoffs and other long-term downsizing options in the future.
Yeah, this was the defense, basically the Defense Department's top financial manager speaking last week at a webinar that was hosted by the Association of Government Accountants. This is Robert Hale, and he was looking beyond. I think this is a response to a question from one of the participants or somebody who was watching about what happens after 2013. Now, as we know, under current law, this is not going to be the only round of sequestration. If Congress and the Obama administration don't agree in some way to turn it off, we're going to have years, I think another eight years of sequesters that will be occurring from 2014 through 2021. They wouldn't incur as dramatically. They wouldn't be as happen as across the board cuts affecting virtually every account. But they would be essentially lowering the spending caps, which are already in place, by around $100 and $110 billion a year. And so the question is then, how do you react if these cuts are going to continue? To essentially long term budget pressure. And what Mr. Hale was saying is that, you know, if we have to go through sequestration in 2014, we're not going to furlough people. We'll start looking at reductions in force and involuntary separation. So essentially you're talking about layoffs.
Yeah, that's where your savings are. And obviously you can tell his frustration. He's quoted as saying, but we're not going to have a repeat of this mess, referring to sequestration.
Exactly. And I mean, he also said that, you know, this is one of the most, you know, he's been controller for around 4 years. He said this is, you know, having to deal with this is one of the most distasteful tasks he's had to undertake. So I think, and he's been a little more vocal than perhaps other federal agency financial managers about how much he dislikes this process.
Well, you know, if history tends to repeat itself, it seems the U.S., after every crisis has passed, World War I, the Civil War, World War II, we downsize and you know, put the military in mothballs, and then along there's always something. And in the case, you know, we now have Korea, which is potentially a major problem, not because they're a serious threat, but because the leader of the country is so off the road. And you have Iran, a problem there. Yemen, we're more and more active in Central Africa and Mali and other countries. And I just don't see the Defense Department over the next 5 years getting smaller.
It's hard to imagine. I mean, if there were, and if there were, you know, if the, you know, there, we do see a real crisis on the Korean Peninsula involving North Korea, I think you'll see a lot of rethinking of sequestration very quickly on Capitol Hill. But it's hard to imagine that Congress and the White House would let sequestration continue past this year. I mean, apparently the administration is going to propose an FY14 budget next week that would not that assumes that sequestration will be turned off next year. It's not going to happen. We aren't, you know, this will be essentially a one-time event. But you just don't know. I mean, nobody thought we were going to, you know, a few months ago, nobody thought we were going to be in the situation that the government's in now, and it happened. So it's very hard to predict, but it is difficult to see DOD, the Defense Department, going through, you know, that, you know, policymakers allowing this to continue, at least as far as it affects the Defense Department.
Yeah, who would have thought that we'd have drones in Mali, and most people would say, who or what or where is a Mali? You know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting, and if there is a problem, a defense-related problem or attack, some of the same people who have been into the sequestration are going to be holding congressional hearings to demand to find out who dropped the ball.
Oh, that's never happened before, has it?
Yeah.
But I think there is another point, though, there that, you know, if sequestration does continue, there's going, you know, it's not going to be enough for agencies to cut travel and conference spending and put on continue a hiring freeze. They're going to have to give some serious consideration, and Congress is going to have to take this into account as well, looking at what they're doing and then what they can afford to stop doing in order to meet this continuing budget pressure.
Right, and furloughs may be the best option rather than layoffs.
Well, certainly from the employee perspective.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, what's the lady we haven't talked about, the poor old Postal Service? It's still pushing to drop a Saturday delivery or first-class mail.
Yeah, it's the never-ending story, isn't
it?
Yeah, I checked their website just before I came into the booth here, and I mean, and they're still, they're still heralding, the Postal Service is still heralding its plan to go to a 5-day mail delivery as of the week of August 5th. Now, currently, though, under the spending legislation that was signed late last month, the Postal Service is barred, as it has been for many years, from reducing the frequency of mail delivery from 6 to 5 days. So we'll see what happens. I mean, the last I heard from the Postal Service, their Board of Governors was scheduled to meet April 9th in a closed session with Postal Service executives to discuss the next steps. And I'm not sure whether that timetable has been accelerated or not, given the Postal Service financial situation. But certainly they're going to have to make a decision about whether to proceed with this. You know, the Postmaster General, when he announced that the Postal Service would go to 5-day mail delivery back in February, while continuing package delivery on Saturdays, you know, he acknowledged there was a possibility of a lawsuit, and I'd say that's a pretty good assumption if they do go forward with this.
Well, you know, when you look at who's going to be helped and who's going to be hurt by this, the people who are going to be hurt are the people who want to get letters, first-class mail, on Saturday. But who benefits from this?
Well, that's the Postal Service's point. They say that, you know, polls show, you know, the people who would benefit primarily are the letter carriers who would, you know, continue to have work to do on Saturdays, which would not be the case necessarily if the Postal Service did drop 6-day mail delivery. But, you know, the Postal Service has touted polls showing that most Americans are okay with dropping Saturday mail delivery, that they don't see any particular harm in it. And, you know, particularly when they're told about the Postal Service financial situation and the projection that this would save $2 billion a year, they generally tend to be supportive.
Well, I don't have an opinion really one way or the other on it, but I've seen this before in Washington. They say we're going to just drop this one service. We're going to eliminate this one thing, but we'll keep everything else. And I could see it where if they drop first-class mail delivery, in 2 years they're back saying, you know, why are we carrying packages around on a Saturday, too, and let's drop that.
Well, I think they probably will continue delivering packages because that's a growth area for them, and that's one reason. You know, they're making that's one segment of the postal business that's been growing, and I think it's going to be an increasingly important revenue stream
Great.
For them going forward.
Hey, thank you, Sean. I let us run over. Thanks very much. Thank you, Lauren, for pushing the boards. See you next weekend here Wednesday. Have a good week.
Thanks, Mike.